The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Susan Strecker, and I am a librarian working here at the Free Library. It is my pleasure to introduce to you today the legendary science fiction author, William Gibson. Called one of the most important novelists of the past two decades by The Guardian, he is the author of Neuromancer, one of the originating novels of the cyberpunk genre that won the science fiction Triple Crown, the Nebula, Philip K. Dick, and Hugo Awards. In it, he coined the term cyberspace and envisioned the internet before it became a reality. Today, he continues to write novels that explore the way technology develops and affects society. His other works include the Sprawl Trilogy, the Bridge Trilogy, the Difference Engine, and two other books in a trilogy that Zero History completes, Pattern Recognition and Spook Country. Set roughly in the present, Zero History follows former rocker Hollis Henry and former addict and translator Milgram as they try to discover the designer behind a very rare brand of denim. Author Cory Doctorow calls it Gibson's best book yet, an exciting adventure that wakes you to the present day's futurism. And I have to agree, reading the book made the world seem new and strange to me, a place that could very well be out of a science fiction novel. Ladies and gentlemen, William Gibson.
Thank you. This is the penultimate reading of the Zero History American tour, because tomorrow there's politics and prose in Washington, D.C., and then I go to London. And then I'll double back and do Canada. And then I'll be done. I will read you a short chapter of this and then invite questions from the audience. Milgram woke, took his medication, showered, shaved, brushed his teeth, dressed, and left the Neo charging but turned on. The UK plug adapter was larger than the phone's charger, keeping the dressmaker's dummy out of his field of vision. He left the room. In the silent Japanese elevator, descending three floors, he considered pausing to Google Hollis Henry on the lobby MacBook, but someone was using it when he got there. He wasn't always entirely comfortable with the lobby here, what there was of it. He felt like he might look as though he were here to steal something, though aside from his wrinkled post-flight clothing, he was fairly certain he didn't. And really, he thought, stepping out into Monmouth Street and tentative sunlight, he wouldn't. Had no reason to. 300 pounds in a plain manila envelope in the inside pocket of his jacket, and nothing today telling him what he needed to do with it. Still a novel situation to a man of his history. Addictions, he thought, turning right toward Seven Dials' namesake obelisk, started out like magical pets, pocket monsters. They did extraordinary tricks, showed you things you hadn't seen, were fun, but came through some gradual dire alchemy to make decisions for you. Eventually, they were making your most crucial life decisions, and they were, his therapist in Basel had said, less intelligent than goldfish. He went to Cafe Nero, a tastier alternate reality Starbucks, crowded now. He ordered a latte and a croissant, the latter shipped frozen from France, baked here. He approved of that. Saw a small round table being vacated by a woman in a pinstriped suit and swiftly occupied it, looking out at the Vidal Sassoon across the little roundabout where young hairdressers were going in to work. Eating his croissant, he wondered what Big End might be up to with designer combat pants. He was a good listener, careful not to let people know it, but Big End's motives and modus eluded him. They could seem almost aggressively random. Military contracting was essentially recession-proof, according to Big End, and particularly so in America. That was a part of it, and perhaps even the core of it. Recession-proofing. And Big End seemed centered on one area of military contracting, the one in which, Milgram supposed, Blue Ant's strategic skill set was most applicable. Blue Ant was learning everything it could, and very quickly, about the contracting, design, and manufacture of military clothing, which seemed, from what Milgram had seen so far, to be a very lively business. And Milgram, for whatever reason or lack of one, was along for the ride. That was what Myrtle Beach had been about. Volunteer armies, the French girl had said, the one who'd worn the plaid kilt at yesterday's meeting in an earlier PowerPoint presentation that Milgram had found quite interesting, required volunteers, the bulk of them young men, who might otherwise be, for instance, skateboarding, or at least wearing clothing suggestive of skateboarding. And male streetwear generally, over the past 50 years or so, she said, had been more heavily influenced by the design of military clothing than by anything else. The bulk of the underlying design code of the 21st century male street was the code of the previous mid-century's military wear, most of it American. The rest of it was workwear, most of that American as well, whose manufacture had co-evolved with the manufacture of military clothing, sharing elements of the same design code. And some team sportswear, of course. But now, according to the French girl, that had reversed itself. The military needed clothing that would appeal to those it needed to recruit. Every American service branch, she said, illustrating each with a PowerPoint slide, had its own distinctive pattern of camouflage. The Marine Corps, she said, had made quite a point of patenting theirs. Up close, Milgram had found it too jazzy. There was a law in America that prohibited the manufacture of American military clothing abroad. And that was where Big End, Milgram knew, hoped to come in. Things that were manufactured in America didn't necessarily have to be designed there. Outerwear and sporting goods manufacturers, along with a few specialist uniform manufacturers, competed for contracts to manufacture clothing for the U.S. military. But that clothing had previously been designed by the U.S. military, who now, the French girl had said, somewhat breathlessly, as though she were closing in on a small animal in some forest clearing, clearly lacked the newly requisite design skills to do that. Having invented so much of contemporary masculine cool in the mid-century, they found themselves competing with their own historical product, reiterated as streetwear. They needed help, the French girl had said, her mouse clicked, summoning a closing flurry of images, and they knew it. He sipped his latte, looking out, watching people pass, wondering if he could see the French girl's thesis proven in the garments of this morning's pedestrians. If you thought of it as a kind of pervasive subtext, he decided, you could. "Excuse me," someone said, "would you mind if I shared the table?" Milgram looked up at this smiling American, ethnically Chinese, in her black sweatshirt, a small plain gold cross, gold chain, worn atop it, gold chained, worn atop it, one white plastic barrette visible, as some unsleeping module of addict street awareness, hardwired to his very core, crisply announced, "Cop." He blinked. "Of course," he said, "you're welcome," feeling muscles in his thighs bunching tight, readying themselves for the dash out the door. "Malfunction," he told the module, "post-acute withdrawal syndrome, flashback." His limbic brain was grooved for this, like the tracks of the wheels of Conestoga wagons, worn ankle deep in sandstone. She put her sack-like white pleather purse on the table, her plastic-lidded pale blue Cafe Nero cup beside it, pulled out the chair opposite him, and sat. She smiled. Embroidered in white on the black sweatshirt were the crescent moon and palm tree of the South Carolina state flag, a bit larger than one of Ralph Lauren's polo ponies. Milgram's buried module instantly extruded an entire dew line of arcane cop sensing apparatus. Paranoia, his therapist had told him, was too much information. He had that now, as the woman dipped into her purse, brought up a matte silver phone, opened it, and furrowed her brow. "Messages," she said. Milgram, looking straight into the infinitely deep black pupil that was the phone's camera. "Uh-oh," she said. "I see I have to run. Thanks anyway." And up, purse under her arm, and out into seven dials, leaving her drink. Milgram picked it up, empty, the white lid smudged with a dark lipstick she hadn't been wearing. Through the window, he saw her pass an overflowing trash canister from which she had likely plucked this cup for her prop, quickly crossing the intersection towards Sassoon, vanishing around a corner. He stood, straightening his jacket, and walked out, not looking around, back up Monmouth Street toward his hotel. As he neared it, he crossed Monmouth diagonally, still moving at a calculatedly casual pace, and entered a sort of brick tunnel that led to Neil's yard, a courtyard gotten up as a kind of New Age mini Disneyland. He bolted through this so quickly that people looked after him, out into Short's Garden, another street. Purposeful pace now, but nothing to attract attention. All the while, aware of his addiction, awakened by the flood of stress chemicals, urgently advising him that something to take the edge off would be a very good idea indeed. It was, some newer part of him thought, amazed, like having a Nazi tank buried in your backyard, grown over with grass and dandelions, but then you noticed its engine was still idling. "Not today," he told the Nazis in their buried tank, heading for Covent Garden Tube Station through an encyclopedic anthology of young people's shoe stores, spring sneakers tinted like jelly beans. "Not good," another part of him was saying, "not good." As much as he wished to appear relaxed, the usual crew of beggars floating in solution on the pavement in front of the station faded at his approach. They saw something. He had again become as they were. He saw Covent Garden as from a great height, the crowd in Long Acre drawing back from him like magnetized iron filings. Take the stairs, advised the autonomic pilot. He did, head down, never looking back, a unit in the spiral human chain. Next, he'd take the first train to Leicester Square, the shortest journey in the entire system, then back without exiting, having assured himself that he wasn't followed. He knew how to do that. But then there were all these cameras in their smoked acrylic spheres, like knockoff Courrèges light fixtures. There were cameras literally everywhere in London. So far, he'd managed not to think about them. He remembered Big End saying that they were a symptom of autoimmune disease, the state's protective mechanisms roiding up into something actively destructive, chronic. Watchful eyes eroding the healthy function of that which they ostensibly protected. Did anyone protect him now? He took himself through what one did in order to determine that one wasn't being followed. While he did so, he anticipated his immediate return to this station, imagined his ascent in the elevator's dead air where a dead voice would repeatedly advise him to have his ticket or pass ready. He would be calmer then restart the day as planned, go to Hackett in King Street, buy pants and a shirt. Not good, said the other voice, causing his shoulders to narrow, bone and sinew tightening almost audibly. Not good. Thank you. All right. Well, any questions? If you have one, raise your hand and someone will bring you a microphone. Oh, okay, good. Yeah.
Could you please talk a little bit about the poetry you find particularly engaging?
The poetry I find engaging? Well, I'm not a very active reader of poetry now and a woefully inactive reader of contemporary poetry. When I was an English major, I read and wrote about the poetry that you read and write about when you're an English major. And I suppose I was most, there's your Eliot and your Thomas. I really like Gerard Manley Hopkins and I was, it was important to my sense of how literature and language works. And I did get to the point where I memorized Dylan Thomas's A Refusal to Mourn. And I can, over the period of time that it takes me to recollect all the words to Thomas's Refusal to Mourn, reduce myself to tears, like literally. And the professor who urged me to do that, not with that particular poem, but he said that each of us should memorize a poem that affected us so powerfully that when we recited it aloud from memory, we would be reduced to tears. And he said, until you've done that, you don't really understand poetry. I took it as a kind of challenge, and it worked. But the poetry that probably affects me more is the poetry that finds its way into modern prose fiction and nonfiction sometimes. So it's kind of osmotic poetry, and also like well crafted pop lyrics. probably have had more effect on me than modern poetry. Okay. Yes, there's. Yes.
You got it? Okay.
Especially in your first two trilogies, you've done a lot of future world building, extrapolating out from trends at the time. Is there anything that you've built into one of your future trilogies that you were kind of surprised to actually start showing up in the real world?
Not particularly. I don't know. These, like, questions... I came to science fiction with considerably less respect for the extrapolative function of futurism than had been traditional in previous generations. And that's never been very important to me. I think that science fiction is invariably about the moment in which it was written and can only be read in hindsight as being about the moment in which it was written. Other than you can say, for instance, that a work of science fiction, Neuromancer in this particular case, utterly fails to envision cellular telephony. And it certainly does. Although, what's more interesting about that for me is when I try to imagine depicting cellular telephony at the ragingly ubiquitous level we now live with it in a work of narrative fiction written in 1981. Like, if you should try that sometime as a thought experiment. It's really, like, it's tough. I don't even think it could have been done in 1981 because none of the characters would ever have been alone. They would all have been talking and texting to one another the whole time. And I think it would have been like disorienting and tedious for the readers of 1981. And I would wonder why any author would bother to put them through that. And so there hasn't been anything. I mean, actually, one thing that I'm still kind of waiting, one thing I'm surprised that no one has built is in Virtual Light, there's a digital inkjet tattoo machine that will give you, like, a tattoo absolutely, you know, pixel-perfect tats. Driven from the art you bring in a thumb drive. It kind of amazes me that, as far as I know, that's not available somewhere. Yes, there in the hat.
I found that Zero History was more amusing, like, overall than your other books. Was that a conscious decision or just something that worked for me? Like, were you trying to make it funnier?
Well, it's perhaps more overtly comical than the previous two books. But, you know, on a good night, if I read from the previous two books, the audience suddenly discovers that it actually is funny. And the humors, I think there are very, very funny, personally, I think, bits in my first three novels. But their overall, this sort of formal tone of fraught, noir, fast forward, covers it up, but I actually intended them to be, in part, fairly droll. And if they weren't, I wouldn't have been able to survive writing them. And, you know, and things being funny has nothing to do with not being serious. Sometimes it's possible to be more serious and to be more serious about really painful and scary things if you're being funny while you're doing it. So. Well, there you go. Let's give this gentleman.
In your last couple of books, it seems you become very interested in military contracting. Do you think you could talk a little bit about why?
Well, I think that this is, we live in an era of military contracting. And we live in an era in which some military contractors are actually providing the boots on the ground. And not just the boots that people are wearing, but the feet that are wearing the boots. And that's new. That actually is new. That's very 21st century, I think. And in lieu of giving you some colorful, imaginary 21st mid-century, when I look at in these three books where I'm dealing with the actual, in some ways actual, first decade of the actual 21st century, in lieu of the imaginary future, what I do is try to pick out the bits that seem to me to be genuinely new, because those will be the bits from which the real mid-century will emerge from. And I think the tendency, particularly in this country, to privatize the military is important. I also think that, you know, I think you'd have to go back to the American Civil War to find an era in which, you know, military contractors could make as much money hand over fist. They didn't really make as much money during the Civil War, but in terms of their global economy, then they made a huge fortune. Yes?
In your books, you seem to fetishize brand names quite often. I was wondering, what kind of research goes into picking the brand names and the items you decide to focus on in your literature?
Well, I think that what brand names are, before us to be fetishized. The people who design brand names designed them to be fetishizable. I'm not the one doing the fetishizing, in my own opinion. Rather, I am performing a naturalistic function in my description of the society around us. We live in a brand-driven society. And some huge percentage of the information that reaches us every day is intended to steer us to one or another brand. And I'm trying to imagine something like the core of creativity from which that sort of thing emerges. One of the things that surprises me in just the overall reading that this book has received, I'm surprised that it hasn't occurred to anyone that the ubiquity of Apple product in these books might not be a joke. And if it is, I don't know if anyone's got it. yet. I mean, my experience of brands, you know, and brands as annoying isn't like, unlike Case Pollard, I don't go into anaphylactic shock if confronted with Tommy Hilfiger product. I just kind of go, oh, geez. You know, it's like, it's boring. It's ubiquitous and it's everywhere. So either when I was doing these books, I gradually got the idea that it would be actually very, very high naturalism to have at least one brand be ubiquitously and tediously present. So. Yes.
I've always admired the range of your fiction, from the steampunk of the Difference Engine through science fiction to modern era novels. Could you give us some idea of what might be interesting you for your next trilogy?
Oh, well, I don't know. Part of, you know, my process, if you can call it that, is so far has been that during the course of the tour for the most recent book, I sort of get emptied out. And by the time I've been home in Vancouver for a couple of months, I'll be really, really bored. And I'll have absolutely no idea. And I sit in front of the typewriter thinking, oh, it's come to this. I have absolutely no idea of what to do next. And that just goes on and becomes incredibly painful until something emerges. But I know it when it, I know when it's emerged because it surprises me. And then the whole cycle begins again. So if I were walking around thinking, as I did yesterday, here's like occasionally I have these sort of waking fantasies of writing a book. I was wondering if it would be possible to write a science fiction novel set maybe in the 1940s, maybe in World War II, in which the protagonist is an unpublished science fiction writer. And indeed, he will remain an unpublished science fiction writer. He'll never be published, but he's extremely prolific and actually in some ways rather talented. And the reader of this novel, in which this guy's a character, would be privy to his work at different periods. So like in the 1940s, he's writing science fiction about the 1960s. And in the 1950s, he's writing science fiction about the 1980s. And he gets a remarkable amount of it right, but he always gets a lot of it totally wrong. And that was as far as I got. But I can tell you from experience that I would be unlikely to ever attempt to write that, because when my conscious walking around mind comes up with an idea for anything, it turns out to be not very good or not very workable. Like in order to get a book started and finished, for me, it has to come from some more unconscious level that I actually have, you know, I have no immediate access to. It just sort of pops to the surface. I go, oh, wow, that's weird. And then we're off again. And that hasn't happened yet, but it probably wouldn't even be due for a few months. Yes.
Hello. I'm going to be very embarrassed if I have this quote wrong, but I think I remember, you being quoted as saying many years ago science fiction was looking further into the future, and more these days it's less about the far future and more about the near future. Is that, Am I attributing that to you correctly?
I could have.
It all gets muddled.
Well, I could well have said that. If I did, it wasn't one of my more piercing moments.
I guess I was curious. A lot of science fiction does seem like the older science fiction. It looked far into the future, and more these days, science fiction is not so far. It's near future. It's tomorrow rather than 10 years from now.
Well, when, you know, in, say, the 1950s, where there was a lot of emergent technology, but nowhere near as much as we have emerging. And there were a lot of, like, potentially very radical technologies were emerging in the post-war era. The rate of change, the rate of technologically driven societal change was so much less than it is, so much less than it is today. And I think that the effect of that is that in the 1950s, a science fiction writer had a rather expansive now on which to build, from which to extrapolate. The now of the 1950s, the kind of reliable now. Here we are. This is the way things are. It won't be like this in the future, but this is the way things are. It was probably about 5 years. We have a now the length of a news cycle, literally. And that narrow and unstable now, it's very, how can you believably extrapolate out to Star Trek? Well, if you extrapolate out to Star Trek, you can do it because people forget about that ugly little bottleneck at the bottom. It's like your space opera universe is like a mattress balancing, as Bob Dylan once said, on a bottle of wine, because it has to get past a whole lot of issues we have coming up in the next 100 years or so, or maybe sooner, that are like very serious big deals and could well result in our not getting, you know, not even getting there as a species. And I think that's one of the reasons science fiction's kind of been winding it back, particularly when the practitioners are intellectually serious about what they're doing. And on that ominous and possibly incomprehensible note, I'm going to thank you all and sign your books. And, okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.